life without hope. Now that's living hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope. Bring me to hope.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. I am your host, Captain Nostalgia, and I'm so happy that you guys decided to hit play for this. This is an episode that is super crucial and super important. It's been a long time since we've gone Hope Speaks Louder, and we decided to take an entire episode to tell one story. So please help me in welcoming the author of After Suicide, Miss Charlotte Underwood.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No problem. So thanks for doing this, because I think reading a little bit of your website and kind of some of your stuff, I've been wanting to have you on the show for a while. So it's cool to kind of finally sit down and have the schedules worked out to do so. But tell us a little bit about just kind of yourself now as a person before we kind of dig into who you are as a person then.
I think... every time someone asks me that, I never know how to respond, because I just feel like I'm just as awkward and problematic as everyone else, and I just feel like I'm as, I guess, it's weird enough, but I feel like I'm as typical as the next person. I'm just human, and that's the only way I can really describe it.
No, it's cool. So, I guess it's... You are the author behind the book After Suicide. As previously mentioned, you're a massive advocate for mental health and coming alongside of those that are feeling the weight of suicide and depression. But you have one of the most interesting and beautiful stories that I think that I've heard in a long time. And we've been doing the show for almost 2.5 years. You talked a little bit about kind of giving me some of your background. You suffer openly with severe depression and anxiety, with a further diagnosis pending. And so what's it like to be both an advocate for something that you suffer with on a day-to-day basis?
I think to be... a good advocate, you need to know what you're advocating. I feel like you need to feel that pain to really fight for it. And it's not to say I don't respect anyone that helps anyway, because the more people that talk, the better. But I think when you've gone through something that is difficult, it gives you so much more passion and strength to really do something about it and make things better so that people don't have to feel that same pain.
No, I get that. And that's, I'm asking that from someone that it still has that, I don't want to say like tendencies, but like still have like those random seasons of depression, because I think that depression is one of those things that when you suffer with it, you might suffer with it like really heavily in a season, but I don't think it's ever something that can truly kind of go away, because I think that sadness and depression is just a part of life in general.
Definitely. I could have a really good couple of days and then I'll be sitting there doing my own thing. Nothing would have happened, and it's just like this big whoomph and your whole body just goes into that stage, and then you can spend the next week or month out that, and then it can change back again. It's complicated, and I think people assume that depression is linear and there's only down, but there are some ups too.
Yeah, and I think that one of the hardest things when you're in depression is learning how to look at the good that's in your life, because depression has this tendency to just make your vision almost just focus solely, kind of like microscopically, on all the things that are bad in your life, whether it's your job or your school or marriage or friends or just all of these circumstances, and you kind of miss out on the good in life as well.
Definitely. I said I've been there quite a lot, and I'm the worst for it, because I'll preach people and tell them that, you know, good things will come, and just because you have a bad debt doesn't mean that that's all that you are going to have. But I'm the worst for it, where I can let it consume me and not see the things that I have, and I'll be sitting there having suicidal thoughts and completely forgetting that I've managed to run a blog, and I've got this dog cuddled up to me and a husband that listens to me and all these good things. But when you're really suffering, it's not that you don't care, it's just that it's almost like you can't feel much else but that pain in that moment when it's really bad.
Yeah, and that pain is like, it's so blinding. It's almost kind of like looking into a white light, and that's all that you can see for that moment, or XYZ, you know, however long it's going to be, like, that's just what you see.
Definitely. I like the term blinding. I think that's a pretty accurate description.
It is. And, you know, I think that, like, my wife can attest to being around me when I go through my, like days of depression now, where I'm like so like aggressively down on myself, like from a guy that runs this podcast and the show and the YouTube channel, where we are just constantly advocating for people to get help when they need it. Like living with someone that can call you out on it firsthand, I think is super, super important. I mean, even if you don't have something like a husband or a wife, like even if you have a friend who knows you so intimately that they can speak to those seasons of redirecting your focus, because sometimes redirecting your focus, it's not an easy thing to do, because that it's so blinding. And kind of when you get into having someone, you know, pull you out of that blind, it's like, man, it's like, what was I doing?
Yeah, I think having someone that you can trust, someone you can outlet those feelings to, is not only one of the healthier options for dealing with mental health and illness, but it also, I think it's one of the strongest tools in recovery, and I can't preach that enough. Just having someone who can talk to you and you can talk to them and communicate through your recovery and your relapses and all the in-betweens, that's the thing that makes progress, I think, because it's when you lack communication, when you lack someone who you really trust and talk to, that's when things get really, really dark.
Yeah, fighting alone, I think, is one of the, like you're talking about, like it's a darkness, and you need those systematically people around you to kind of really speak to that. Whether it is, you know, your depression or just depression on the surface, or whether or not it's leading to other things like addiction or self-harm or even kind of plotting out your own suicide. It's having someone in your life, like you're saying, like it progress is progress. And to make progress happen, you need to have someone who can monitor you and hold you accountable to that.
Yeah. And I think it's also important as well that people need to understand, and more the people who, I guess, haven't been through that there's a difference between having someone in life that we can talk to and having someone we can trust, because we could have someone to talk to, but we can almost love them too much so that we can't trust them to know how we feel, because we don't want to let them down. Because trusting someone to know all of these things in your head, it's vulnerable, and you need to trust that that they can handle it, and also that they're not going to reject you. So it's a big thing.
Yeah. And I couldn't agree more. And so you're actually this dual person, and It's very rare that I meet people like yourself in doing this. But you have survived a suicide attempt yourself, but you've also been on the receiving end of losing someone to suicide. I guess my first question is kind of what came first for you? Was it the suicide attempt or the surviving the suicide for?
My story is very complicated because I talk about my suicide attempt, but I don't talk about the other ones because I did it differently. I spent from the age of 14 to 18 with, I guess, half-hearted suicide attempts where I wanted to see how far I could push my body in hopes that one day I would cave, my body would cave, and so people couldn't judge me. So they'd think, oh, she just got really ill, because that seemed better than being called a victim of suicide. It's just the whole stigma that terrified me. I didn't want to let people down. So I had suicide attempts before my father's suicide, but the one that I talk about often, the one that landed me in hospital, that was a month after he buried my dad.
That's so heavy. Like I was when I was a teenager, like I thought about suicide a lot, and I went through this really bad heartbreak, and man, I thought how I would write out my suicide note. Like I wrote a lot of poetry at the time. It was very much a cry for help. And when I started like opening up to people about it, I found myself like kind of feeling relieved about it. But then I lost a friend to suicide, and it was kind of like felt like almost two steps back to me. So what's for you, what was it like to kind of struggle all those years with kind of, you know, toying between attempting suicide and living normal life, and then to only have your dad actually commit suicide a couple years later?
I think it's important, for one, to remember how good people of mental are at acting. We could win awards for our acting. We're very good at hiding our feelings when we need to. And I was a bullied kid, so I was very scared of having more bullying, I guess, because if you're seen as upset or depressed, that's a really negative thing, or at least it was when I was a teenager, so I kept that quiet to protect myself. So that's what caused self-harm and drinking. But the sad thing is I dealt with my suicidal thoughts by writing out over the course of years different suicide notes, and I actually kept a letter, I think, for certain people under my bed. So there's one for my dad, one for my mum, for certain friends, and it'd be like a final goodbye. And I remember when I had a year, I think, where I got a bit better, and I remember ripping those letters up because I had an outlet. I think at the time I had someone I trusted and I could talk to, and I felt so free when I let go of that. And even though it wasn't permanent or it didn't turn out to be, just having that freedom for a few months or a year, that was good. But then obviously Dad passed away, all the progress I made went straight back. Everything I had built on crumbled, because he was the person that I spoke to. He was the one that would get me out of funks. He was the one that would give me real advice without bubble wrapping it or being insulting. He was just very real. And so it was more than just losing a dad. It was losing my... He was losing the person who had kept me alive the last 4 years.
And that's a heavy thought. And I think that too, like when you look at... When you experience a suicide, it catches you off guard immensely. And, you know, when you receive the news that your dad had passed away, like, what was your first initial thought? Did you kind of start questioning back all of these moments that you had shared together, all of those, you know, like you had talked about, having your dad being a support system for you, like, what was your initial thought at hearing your dad's cause of death?
It was difficult because my dad was actually missing for a month before he was found. And I think the first day I went out to search for him, I just had this image in my head of him ending his life. And I just knew. So when it happened, I was still in a... When I got the confirmation, it was a shock, but I think I knew it all along. And I think I wasn't mad because I couldn't be mad at someone who was going through what I had gone through. And the only difference is that I survived and he didn't. It wasn't a difference between who was stronger. It was just chance. I wasn't mad, but I know a lot of people around were very confused and had questions and couldn't understand it and called him selfish. And there was a lot of pain and everyone dealt with it so, so differently.
So kind of life is we just did the walk out of suicide, the walk out of darkness, suicide prevention walk here about a month and a half ago. And, you know, just talking with people there that had also experienced a suicide. Suicide is one of those things that when it is a friend, and I would imagine it's even harder as a family member, it's extremely hard to adjust to life after that. So what was it for you personally? How do you adjust back to your normal life after a loss like that?
It took a bloody long time, and no one ever tells you that. I went through trying, obviously I tried to end my life right afterwards because I realized that he was in fact dead and he wasn't coming back, and that took a long time to settle, because when someone dies by suicide and you don't see it and they just vanish off the face of the earth, you start to tell yourself these things that maybe they'll still turn up, maybe it was staged, maybe it's not real because you don't have the proof, they've just vanished. That was the hardest part. I started drinking again at one point and self-harming, toxic relationships. I was sabotaging myself because I didn't want to live without my dad. But then I met my husband and he was very patient with me, and very supportive. And eventually, just because he was showing me so much respect for my mental health, I started to heal. And I think the moment I realized with his support that I didn't have to stop grieving and that I didn't have to do what people told me and all these things in terms of grief, that's when I started to come back around to who I was. Because you get people who tell you you need to move on, which you don't have to do, because that's like telling someone to forget that someone existed. And that you can spend as long as you like grieving and having bad days, and that you can do it in your own way, because mistakes may be made, but the point is that you're in a tough time. That realization, that was a big thing, really.
No, I understand. And like, grieving is one of those things that just it takes a long time for you to adjust to that, especially after experiencing something like a loss of suicide, and or even just a loss period. It's something that takes a long time to kind of put back in focus. And like you said, like it, especially if you're close with that person, that grief, it hits you to depths that you didn't even know existed, and can, you know, still haunt you for years to come. I mean, it took me, like, I was really close to my grandmother growing up, and when I lost her to cancer, I think it took me probably like close to like 10 years of just mourning to kind of move on with my life. Is that something that you still see yourself struggling with from day to day?
I've got to a point where I can talk about him without completely shutting down. I've gotten to a point where I don't cry every second of the day, and that I don't need to perform rituals, which I think in early stages help a lot of people. But the thing I've noticed is that even though I feel like I'm at a place where I'm starting to live again, and that I don't have to die along with him, I still have the nightmares where I'm still searching for him and trying to find him. And I think subconsciously, it's just not something you ever completely get over. And I think that's what these dreams are, of searching for him. It's just a subconscious that when you lose someone, especially when it's sudden and it's shocking, I think even when you're trying to carry on with your life, you still want that old part of your life back, and you try hard, you find it hard to let go even when you think you have, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And I fully agree with that. But you here in your email, you kind of like, as you're sharing your story writtenly, you talk about kind of just being ill and refusing to admit it, not wanting to get help because you're being scared and alone. It looks like you talked about going through the season of your life where you just went through substance abuse and sex abuse, and were essentially just trying to find an escape from this news or this reality. So what was that season of your life kind of like, and what's it like coming out of a season like that?
It was a very similar part of my life that happened when I was a bit younger. There was a gap where I was in recovery between before my father's death and when it happened. So I sort of fell back, as I said. But it was... I'm someone that really encourages people to talk about their feelings and not be ashamed of who they are, because I'm so guilty of doing that myself, and I have done that myself. I still now and again do it today, and I have to kick myself for it. But I think essentially I did these things because I felt so much pain inside, so much anger, but I didn't want to hurt anyone. It was always about everyone else. I was always thinking about how my actions would affect each other, how my feelings would affect other people. And how I felt if I dealt with it on my own in the privacy of my room and dealt with my pain all by myself, then no one else would have to suffer for me. And that felt like I was doing a good thing, I guess, in my head at the time.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. And I kind of went through a similar situation where, like, out of my depression, like, I thought that bottling it in was healthier for me, that I was taking this route out. And I've talked about it here with, you know, my addiction to pornography, and it's kind of birthed out of that season of depression. And I mean, really has, like, really screwed up some of my day-to-day life now, and just kind of learning to kind of overcome with that as well. And so You talked about After Suicide is the book that you have written, and it is kind of about dealing with your father's suicide. What was the process like for you in writing this book?
Before that book, I'd spent time, a few attempts, trying to write a book or something, because I had recently quit a job due to my mental health. I was suicidal, but I was also bored at home, and I felt guilty for being at home while my husband's at work, and I felt if I didn't do something productive, then I was failing. So writing brought me above water, nothing stuck, and then I thought about what mattered to me, what really bothered me in this world, and I thought about Dad. And I thought about how when I was in grief, there was absolutely no help for people who had lost someone to suicide. There isn't many services in the area. There's very few services in the UK. And if you search online, aside from a few forums, if you want a book on grief, you have to pay £20. And I thought, what if I what if I get something which anyone can access and people can see that suicide is really, really difficult and it's not glamorous and the after effects are tragic, but you can recover. It's not easy, but you can. And writing it really helped me, because when someone close to you dies by suicide, everyone suddenly wants to know your story. Everyone wants to know about how it happened, what you did. And so you find yourself telling snippets all over the place, what happened. And you get a bit confused. So putting it all down in one place, that felt good, because it felt like I had not closed the book on it, but I had, I guess, put it to one side and I could focus on a life outside of being the girl whose dad ended his life, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And that's a message that I think a lot of people need to hear. And I think that, you know, I sometimes often wonder, is our suicide rate so high because of the stigma that is A, that's around the subject, and B, also, you know, having someone commit suicide, like not commit suicide, but also at the same time, you know, making therapists and things like that so inaccessible. And so kind of, you know, having someone be able to pick up a book like After Suicide and read through it and say, all right, I relate with this, and you know, I can see that the importance of, you know, having an outlet or talking with someone and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at any of my work, I am notoriously blunt and I don't sugarcoat, I don't glamorize. I give the ugly side of mental health, because mental illness can be incredibly ugly to live with. It's not as attractive as maybe some parts of the internet make it to be, but I always show the side of hope, and I always show the other side of illness and the things that I've still done and achieved and the things that have been successful despite it. And that seems to help most people, because it's an important message, I think.
I totally agree, and I'm so glad that you kind of mentioned achievements, that word right there, because it is possible to live with mental issues and mental health problems, and there are a lot of people that don't like talking about it, and it's an ugly thing. I don't know how many live events we've done where we'll willingly start talking about the statistics of suicide just alone, and they just, like, people are baffled that suicide rates are so high and that they've continued to increase over the past couple of years. And, you know, but having someone that is having resources out there like After Suicide and like Victims and Villains and Geek Devotions and these websites and American Foundation for Suicide Prevention that are looking and willing to show you that, hey, normal people suffer with this. It's not glamorous, but it can be overcome, and it can be something that you can point and overcome and live with. It doesn't have to be the end of you.
No, not at all. My dad, he died by suicide, and his medical records for mental illness dated back to 1996, but that's only from when they're recorded. It could have been longer. But my dad still literally went from living a life in poverty to a life in a huge house, a very comfortable living with a wife and three children, which was a dream for him. That was important to him, his family. He had a job where he was so good at it, and he served for 25 years. He's a prison officer, and he was on track to become governor, which he turned down so that he could help his prisoners. And he ended up writing a book, meeting Princess Anne, getting numerous degrees, starting his own hypnotherapy business, he never stopped, despite all of the things that were going on in his head, all of the things that we had no idea were happening until his death. And he suffered it alone, but he is proof that you can still do whatever you want, even if it takes longer, even if it's difficult, even if you follow a different path, you can do it.
Yeah, and I think that opening up about it really, it's the first step towards kind of recovery. Like, whether you're talking about addiction, I think is the first step of, you know, looking at the 12-step program that, you know, stuff like AA or NA that they use, you know, talking about the first step towards recovery is to admit that you have a problem. And I think it's one of the hardest things to admit to, because we don't like to see ourselves in these negative lights, but it's something that, it's kind of like ripping a Band-Aid off. It's like, once that Band-Aid comes off, it's like, it's freeing to every degree possible. And so, you know, kind of being around that growing up, did you ever feel like, I don't know what I was gonna, where I was going with that. But you also, on top of the book, you also run a website. It is charlotteunderwoodauthor.wordpress.com. And where you do blog posts a couple times a week, as well as poetry. What is it kind of like for you as continuing to challenge yourself, not only as a suicide survivor and a mental health advocate, but also as an author, to be open and honest with every new post and every new poem that is published to your site?
It's terrifying. Admitting to the world on social media in front of all these people and potential employers and people that you might meet, that's scary, because you don't know how people are going to take it. But at the same time, I felt so trapped. I didn't talk about my mental health. So now it's just like someone says to me, oh, are you depressed then or something? Or they bring up my illness and I'm like, yep. And the world knows it, but so what? Because it matters. My illness matters. But it shouldn't be judged. It's not a stigma to me. And that makes it all worth it, I think, because there's nothing that anyone can say to me now which I haven't already put out there. And that's quite liberating.
No, I understand. And you talked about, you know, you talk about the recovery process that you, so what is like a recovery process from you, from like day to day? Does it look the same? Does it change? Has it evolved?
Oh, my recovery process is entirely random, depending on the day. I get very unpredictable mood swings, I guess. I can go through one half of the year an entirely different person to who I become the other half of the year. I can be absolutely having the best day of my life and then suddenly out of nowhere fall into a crisis and need help for suicide intervention. So recovery is just about judging how I'm feeling the night before or the morning and adjusting my day to that. It's cancelling plans if I have to, or making them if I need to get out of the house, and writing down feelings, forcing myself to talk to my husband about it because I know that I need to let it out, and just listening to what I need rather than, I guess, doing what people expect me to do. It's a lot of self-respect. I think recovery is self-respect, most part of it.
That's beautiful. And I never really thought about it like that, but it very much is a self-respect, because you are trying to better yourself. And if you can better yourself, you can better those around you. There was a band years ago that had the quote, how much love do you know to show if you have no love for yourself? And I think that learning to love yourself is something that not only affects you physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally, but it's something that also affects those around you, and it makes you more of a pleasant person to be around.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to stress people out by telling them about how I feel about being selfish, because people don't like that word. They assume it is a very negative thing. But I always say to people, you need to be selfish. You need to put yourself as a number one priority. Your child is not your priority. Your husband's not your priority. Your pet isn't. Because at the end of the day, if you don't look after yourself, if you don't put yourself first when you need to, if you don't maintain your health, both mental and physical, you may not be there to support or love those you love. So if you end up ending your life, you can't prioritize your family members. If you get so mentally unwell that you're unable to function, you're not going to look after your loved ones. It's hard to think about, but as an individual, you are, I don't know what's the word, you are your own number one. That's how you've got to live without being nasty to other people about it, I guess, in fewer words.
No, and I totally agree. And like we talked before, earlier in the show, about how community is so important to recovery. And you said that, you know, you can't stress that enough. Well, if you don't learn to take care of yourself first and to be honest and love yourself, then there's no community. So, you know, looking after yourself first and foremost, it has an effect on the rest of your life and the rest of your well-being and those around you, because if you don't have a community, you're almost in a sense kind of damning yourself.
No, I absolutely agree.
So you are now currently also enrolled into the care program approach, beginning therapy in the course as well. And so what's it kind of like to seek this help out and continue to influence your life and your advocacy for mental health?
Getting help is very difficult, because it's not just getting help from professionals, it's getting to a point where you can mentally manage that. Just admitting to a doctor, who, it can be a very overwhelming thing to do, that, you know, you've got depression because you don't know how they're going to react. So obviously admitting and seeking help, that's a big step, and that alone is a process. Then in the UK, getting any form of help is hard. It's waiting lists and hurdles, and you've got to be this and that and XYZ. What I had was a care program approach, which is usually for people who need to learn to manage their anxiety or their depression. So people who, like in my case, no longer leave the house because they're too scared. And it helps to have the support. It helps to have someone guide you when you don't really know how to help yourself. And there's that. And obviously, I'm still trying to get therapy, so that's still a process, but that's something I'm determined to do, because I've come to a point in my life where I know that that is what I need. And I think the more you seek help and the more you research it and the more you ask for it, you will know what will work for you. And it doesn't matter how many times you have to keep trying, when you get it is the best thing in the world.
And I couldn't agree more. And so before we kind of close out, I want to ask you this as winding down. What are practical steps do you think someone listening to this right now who might be thinking about suicide, or you know, whether or not they are debating whether or not they should tell their family and friends about their battle with mental health? What are practical ways of encouragement you think that you could offer up?
I think in terms of practical ways, the best thing that I ever did was write it down, because it can be incredibly hard to use your voice when you're trying to tell someone anything big like that, whether it's about your sexuality or something you've done or your mental illness or that you want to end your life. It can be hard to say that verbally. So writing it down, that's the biggest thing that ever helped me. And you can use that of doctors as well. They'll accept that. It's just take your time, don't rush it, don't let anyone control it for you. It needs to be something you do for yourself, because you do deserve the help, but you also need to want it. And ultimately, it's a decision that you will make, and taking little steps and easing into it and finding your own path, that's what's going to get you the most reward.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And writing it down, I think, is something that really helps a lot. Because not only that, it's also cool to kind of go back and see where you were and kind of how you've grown at the same time. It really, even when you think you haven't made progress, it's making progress. My wife has really bad migraines, and like when she went to go to a doctor told her, you know, keep a headache diary when you're having these issues, and you know, she can go back and she can start seeing, like, this is what I was feeling on Tuesday the 11th, or this is what I'm feeling now on Christmas Day. Like, you can see that progress that's been made in such a short time. And I think depression and suicide are definitely one of those things that you can do that with as well, because you can, not only that, Renee Gyokhi from To Write Love on Her Arms, she put out a book called Purpose for Pain, and in it she just diaries what she's feeling each day, and it just how she went from like this like severely suicidal of the person to now being an advocate for mental health and suicide prevention. Her journey throughout that book is astonishingly beautiful and honest and real. And I think that that's a great practical step that I haven't heard on here before. So thank you for sharing that with me.
No problem. It works a lot for me, so I rely on it.
All right. I just want to kind of close on this, and you can comment on it as well, but you write in this email, you said, quote, "My only goal now, my passion and a dream, is to carve a world where stigma is gone, where there are more support and treatment options from mental health, and where suicide is no longer becomes such an ever-growing cause of death." And that's why we publish the content that we do. So I'm going to give you a platform to build on that if you want.
Obviously, I think the more people we can encourage to talk, the more change we'll make.
Agreed. And so with that, if you guys are listening to this right now and you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States of America. There are 123 suicides that take place each and every day right here in our own backyard. And for every successful one of those suicides, 25 more being attempted, 3,075 suicides right here in our own backyard. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That's one death roughly every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. You guys can call the Suicide Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. Also, text anonymously to 741-741. Or you guys can also go to victimsandvillains.net/hope, where you guys can find even more resources past those. Charlotte, did you want to add anything else to that?
Well, just that to the people that are listening, you know, you do deserve help, and you deserve to live the life that you want. And there's no shame in having a mental illness.
Amen. So where can people find you online and find your book and your website?
Mainly the best way to find me is on Twitter, because I'm always on that platform, which is @C_UK. And if they wanted to read my work, then it's best to go on my website, which is charlotteunderwoodauthor.com.
All right. Well, you guys can find us everywhere on just search Victims and Villains. If you guys like what we stand for, consider supporting us on Patreon. For as little as $2 a month, you guys can dictate the content that we publish. Or you guys can also go to Etsy.com, where you guys can find our Etsy shop and help support us and get mental health resources into schools and conventions and all over the world. Charlotte, thank you so much for this.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. Until next time, remember to keep talking nerd, talking hope, and speaking nothing else.
That's Entertainment Podcast Network. Entertainment and culture. Artist owned, fan supported.